Hey, this is Cedric Jungelman, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. Before we get into this important rip with Joe Burnett on how your wealth is melting, why Bitcoin is the deep freeze that your portfolio definitely needs, I want to give a quick shout out to our amazing Bitcoin-focused sponsors that I use myself and recommend to my friends and family. Today's episode is brought to you by River, the preferred choice for buying Bitcoin. Why do I recommend River? Because I personally use the service and they offer zero fees on recurring Bitcoin purchases. You can dollar cost average hourly, daily, weekly, or monthly. Every Bitcoin is stored in a one-to-one multi-sig cold storage, meaning your assets are always accessible. Plus, with US-based phone support, help is just a call away. They also have this cool feature called Riverlink, which allows you to send Bitcoin via text to anyone, which can be claimed to any wallet. River makes it simple and secure to save your wealth in Bitcoin. Get up to $100 when you sign up and buy Bitcoin on partner.river.com/matrix. With Thea, your Bitcoin stays in your control. Thea's module multi-sig gives you full control to create a setup that meets your specific needs. Cold storage with your favorite hardware wallets, mobile vaults for ease of use, or inviting a family member or financial advisor to hold your key in a collaborative manner. Support for your favorite Bitcoin hardware wallets like Trezor, Coldcard, Ledger, Foundation, and Jade. Add these devices as signing keys in your Thea multi-sig with ease. And Thea's comprehensive suite of security and recovery tools ensures you'll always have access to your Bitcoin, even if you lose a key or Thea is no longer available. Full control over your Bitcoin. Experience true Bitcoin ownership with Thea. Final thought, now is the perfect time to stack sats and store them tightly. Thea is the best place to do that. Bar none, check it out. Download Thea at thea.us/Cedric. That's thea.us/Cedric. And get your first 6 months free and secure your multi-generational Bitcoin legacy today. This podcast, from recording to editing to marketing, is 100% self-ran by yours truly. All boosts on the Found app go directly toward making future episodes as awesome as possible for you. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix for this thought-provoking conversation with my man, Joe Burnett.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Joe Burnett is Senior Product Marketing Manager at Onchained, the official U.S. collaborative custody partner of Bitcoin Magazine. Joe is also the host of the Bitcoin Frontier podcast. Joe Burnett, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you, sir?
Hey, Cedric. Thanks for having me on. I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to chat. We haven't done this in almost a year, since May 15th of 2023, when you did the Power of Bitcoin, Joe Burnett, on saving wealth at scale and hyper-Bitcoinization. So it's going to be sort of building on that, I think. And but how you been in the meantime? How's the new job?
Yeah, been doing great. I joined Onchained, I guess, after we had last spoken. I joined, I think, in September of 2023, but it's been great. I love being able to help people get self-custody of their Bitcoin, get coins off exchanges. I don't think there's many things more important than that right now, especially in the world of Bitcoin. So excited to be here and excited to chat.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, we love Onchained. It's definitely, we love it in the Jungelman family. And, speaking of, you never know what can happen. I was walking home from the bus stop today, like a block and a half from my house. My wife's coming back from a different bus stop from where my drops off my son. So like we're facing each other and she's like, right behind you. And I'm like, nah, whatever. And then like, I kind of see a blur and I'm thinking, nah, maybe a raccoon. And it's a bobcat. I turn around, there's a bobcat behind me. Broad daylight, it's like 7:30 in the morning. Maybe like 40 yards from me, not even, maybe 20 yards. And I kind of was trying to like track a little bit. My wife's like, don't go. But then it was like slinging through the houses. So, you know, you never know what could happen. So you definitely want to be in a place where, you know, think about multi-generational wealth, and you want to secure your Bitcoin for generations, even if you're not around. So also, I think, did you start your career at Ernst & Young or early in your career?
Yes.
Recruiting-wise?
Yep.
So I'm also an alumni. Probably chatted about this a little bit on the last show. And so, you know, I love your writing as well. So reason, you know, I'm excited to chat this time around is your latest report, because you put out great research. And this one's called Your Wealth is Melting. So I'd love to know, you know, kind of what inspired you to write this report.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, before I get into that, I scary story about the Bobcat. I guess Unchained can help protect your Bitcoin from Bobcats. yeah, so I recently published this report titled Your Wealth is Melting. And one of the reasons why I decided to write this report was I think a lot of people, especially outside, you know, the fairly small Bitcoin community, think of Bitcoin completely the wrong way. They think of Bitcoin as this extremely speculative lottery ticket that, you know, could be worth millions of dollars one day, but could also be worth $0 tomorrow. And I think it's true that Bitcoin could someday be worth millions of dollars, but I don't think it's correct to think of Bitcoin as this speculative lottery ticket that, you know, might has good odds of being completely worthless. I think a better way to think about Bitcoin is it's actually just money. And if you look at Bitcoin and you identify Bitcoin's unique monetary properties compared to all other monetary tools, you'll notice that Bitcoin has the most superior monetary properties. It's portable, durable, divisible, scarce, portable, or fungible, et cetera. And so Bitcoin is the superior money, but most people don't know or think about what money actually is. And if Bitcoin is actually the most superior form of money, which I think it objectively is, humans use money to measure and track their wealth, right? Like that's exactly what money is for. It's for trading and savings. It doesn't have to be any other particular use case. It's just for holding and potentially sending in the future and then measuring your wealth over time and calculating, you know, economic profit or financial loss. And I think a lot of people don't think about Bitcoin this way. And what they really should be doing is thinking about Bitcoin as money and then evaluating their traditional assets in Bitcoin terms, looking at, you know, their passive index funds denominated in money in Bitcoin and seeing that their passive index funds are actually crashing, or that their house is actually crashing, or their gold, or whatever other traditional assets they have. And so I think that was kind of the objective behind the report, is to reframe people's thinking and realize like, hey, you know, my wealth is going up in dollar terms, which the government is creating more of year after year, but my wealth is actually crashing or melting in Bitcoin terms. And that's kind of where I started with the report.
Wow. Yeah. I noticed there's some other, sort of people or prior authors that kind of inspired this. So who is, and I don't know if I'm saying his last name right, but who is Eugene, is it Fama?
Yeah, he's basically the creator of the efficient market hypothesis. So the idea that markets trend toward efficiency over time, and there's different like forms of the efficient market hypothesis. There's like strong form, weak form. And it, in my opinion, it doesn't matter like which form you particularly believe in. It's more of the idea that capitalism is going to appropriately price asset prices over time. And just like Jeff Booth's idea of technology deflation, markets get more and more efficient over time. And it's kind of the idea of if you're walking down the street and you see a $100 bill in the on the sidewalk, most likely if you don't pick it up, someone else right behind you is going to go pick it up. So there aren't very many easy short-term profits to be made that are above, you know, the market rate of return. So yeah, that's he's one of the guys that I mentioned in the report that's definitely a little outside the traditional Bitcoin world.
Yeah, well, let's break down some more of these ideas and maybe we'll come back to Bitcoin and maybe focus sort of on legacy assets or just sort of thinking. But I'd love to kind of get into how is innovation a double-edged sword, and maybe the example you could use is sort of calculators.
Yeah, it's a great point. So I think a lot of people are investing in things like big tech or FANG or, you know, whatever, or the Magnificent Seven or whatever it's the current phrase for, you know, these technology companies is. And they're trying to like capture this upside in new technology. Yet, as you know, people like Jeff Booth has pointed out, technology is inherently deflationary and markets are relatively efficient, or they trend toward efficiency. And so there's a scenario in the report talking about calculators where it's like, okay, you know, calculators used to be a luxury item that, you know, a few people had in their household, maybe in like the 1960s or 1970s or whenever it first originated. Maybe they cost $300 adjusted for inflation. So not everyone had calculators originally. Some people may have, you know, thought that it would be a good idea to go out there and invest in calculator producers, companies that go out and produce calculators. But eventually, as we know with technology, everyone has a calculator on their computer, on their iPhone, on a smart device, on, you know, all sorts of different devices, effectively for free. It's a value add on another product that's kind of further upstream that, you know, didn't exist, you know, in the 1960s or 1970s. So if you were investing solely in being able to produce a better calculator, you most likely, you know, maybe the company did really well in the 1980s or something, and then eventually crashed back down and you needed to pivot your business into a completely different product or service. And so the idea of like investing in innovation is kind of the same concept where it's like, okay, if you were stuck investing in calculator producers, you may have did really well for a little bit, but then you lost all of your money because you needed to pivot into a completely different product or service. But the real winner behind all of this was the consumer, right? Now we all get to enjoy a free calculator on any of our devices, and we can buy infinite calculator apps for, you know, zero Bitcoin or even $0. So I think this is like a very extreme example, as calculators have actually gone completely to zero. But I think this concept of technology deflation and efficient markets providing value to consumers, and then most of the value from this new technology being captured by consumers, applies to everything on a long enough time horizon.
Yeah, it's kind of a really way of flipping sort of like your intuitive thinking about it. And I like how you kind of phrase it as like sort of the advantage shifts to the consumer over time. So then how would you apply that same thinking to, like, you know, AI and strawberries and investing there? Because, so, you know, I think a lot of people would be like, all right, well, I got one for you. Like, how about this? Like, how is that going to not play out in my advantage?
Yeah, exactly. So the follow-up section of the report right there is a like case study scenario of what would happen in the future if there's an AI and robotics breakthrough over the next, you know, 2 or 3 decades that completely automates something like strawberry farming and distribution of the strawberries, like shipping it from, you know, the farm to the house or your local supermarket. And the idea is very similar to calculators, where it's like, okay, if this does occur, then the current or the first strawberry farms to implement this technology might immediately be able to, you know, produce strawberries for 99% cheaper than before. And initially the market, you know, as they're the first people to do this, they might still be able to sell their strawberries at the current market price, and consumers will keep paying the current market price. Of course, what this means is those early strawberry farmers that are adopting this new technology will end up, you know, seeing massive profits. They might try to, you know, sell the business. They might try to start more strawberry farms. Other people might see that, hey, you can make a lot of money right now just making strawberries because of this new, awesome new technology. And so all of this, you know, because of efficient markets, because of capitalism, other companies come in. That could be existing companies or it could be new entrants. They adopt the same technology or similar technology that, you know, automates the production and distribution of strawberries. And now the market price for consumers of the strawberries starts collapsing down toward the cost of production. And so, you know, there was a short period where maybe the equity in the first strawberry companies that implemented this technology, you know, did really well. And if you happen to be owning them, you did fantastic. But in the long run, the wealth didn't accrue to the strawberry companies that were, you know, producing strawberries, just like the calculator companies that were producing calculators. The wealth ended up accruing to the consumer when the, you know, price of strawberries was collapsing. And, you know, I think this whole idea can occur for basically all consumer goods on a long enough time horizon. And it also occurs for all companies on a long enough time horizon. Whereas if one company is just printing money, like the strawberry farm initially, when there's a lack of competition using this new technology, then there's going to be competitors that come in and devalue the present value of their future cash flows for that strawberry farm. And so if you store wealth in these assets that are outside of Bitcoin, effectively, they can either be produced more of them, like gold or real estate, or devalued like the strawberry farm with other competitors coming in and taking some of their market share or lowering the market price of strawberries. And so Bitcoin is kind of this one asset that you can hold and it can't be produced more of. It's the one thing that humanity cannot devalue or debase, no matter how much energy or time or resources are poured into, you know, creating more Bitcoin.
Yeah. And I really like how you put it in the report. In the context of the strawberry farming and distribution breakthroughs, most people today would be holding and rebalancing equities or bonds in various competing strawberry companies, anticipating a share in the profit from technological advancements, temporary monopolies, or the short-term advantages conferred by intellectual property law. However, in a world with finite money, the actual value accrual would favor Bitcoin savers in the long run, as technology advancements and competitive markets drive real strawberry prices down by 99% and excess profits towards zero, the price of strawberries may fall from 100 sats to 1 sat. In other words, the relative value of Bitcoin per strawberry would increase by 100 times. Michael Saylor is famous for saying that saving your wealth in Bitcoin and only Bitcoin is not about conviction, but about rational thinking. What is the innovation trap?
Yeah, so it's effectively this idea of kind of what we're talking about, where you can invest in this new technology that is, you know, the calculator companies or the strawberry farms that are using artificial intelligence and robotics to completely automate the production of strawberries. But it's a double-edged sword, like we're talking about, where free markets come in and start driving down the selling cost of strawberries toward the cost of production for those strawberries, even if there's a temporary, you know, new way to produce strawberries. There, it doesn't make sense to necessarily perpetually keep your wealth in these, you know, innovative new companies. And so you're kind of like, and that's kind of what we're all doing today. Like, we're all holding like passive index funds and trying to move our profits to the very next company over and over and over again. And there's no way to actually just save for the future, even though that's kind of what we're trying to do. And so that's the innovation trap. We're all perpetually looking for the next innovative new technology or new company. And there's nothing wrong with doing that. Like, there's always going to be people, you know, innovating and investing for in the future, but it's a problem when there's no way to actually save for the future by just holding good money. And so that's the innovation trap. It's like today we're searching for the next best AI company or the next best NASDAQ company, whereas reality is those things can be innovated away, whether it's, you know, we can produce, you know, different competitors out there or whatnot. So yeah, that's kind of the general idea of the innovation trap.
Right. And I think I like how you kind of get into, like, you can do well in these things, but just really over shorter time frames or timing it well or kind of having competitive advantages or sort of an insider edge. And you go on to write, with the examples of calculators and strawberry farms in mind, we can begin to see how the rapid acceleration of production impacts our ability to save and how Bitcoin may be the asset class that increasingly captures a significant share of total global wealth, all the time when global wealth is rapidly increasing due to the relentless acceleration of innovation. In a world of abundance, hyperproductivity, and intensely competitive markets, storing significant wealth outside of Bitcoin will be increasingly difficult. And that sort of brings us to the next, you know, section of the report, which I thought this was fascinating, the way you kind of look at this. So, you know, what is sort of the acceleration of production, and maybe we'll go through some of the sectors of the economy that people don't kind of see it in. And maybe we can start with farming. And maybe you could just describe how, you know, the acceleration of production and farming has been over the last maybe 2 or 3 centuries.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, the key idea with this section is it may be like highlighting what people already intuitively know. Like I think over the last 200 plus years, people might assume or be clear that, you know, obviously we're becoming more productive at producing some of these basic consumer goods, but it contrasts with the price that they're seeing, you know, at their local supermarket when it comes to food, for example. And so it's kind of an interesting dynamic where it's like, okay, you know, I can see how we're becoming more productive at farming or data storage or oil or producing lumber, but these things are getting more expensive. How is that possible? So it's kind of just that idea of tying these things to this innovation that we're seeing in the world, but then also realizing that, you know, these things are getting more expensive. And in the case of farming, for example, in 1930, one American farmer could feed four people. By the 2010s, one farmer was feeding 155 people. So there's this massive breakthrough in being able to feed more people and produce more food, but food is more expensive, especially in dollar terms. And like, that's by design too. Like the dollar is effectively a unit of account that's tied to a basket of consumer goods. And this unit of account that's tied to this basket of consumer goods is being debased year after year against these consumer goods. And just like the farming example, we're becoming extremely productive at producing these consumer goods. So the dollar is kind of getting wrecked in both ways, where it's getting devalued anyways against this basket, but this basket is getting easier and easier to produce year after year.
Right. That's kind of a nice way to put it, or a very interesting angle. So then, you know, what about data storage and, you know, using the example of clay tablets?
Yeah. So one of the...
Oh, actually, I'm sorry. I want to go back a little bit just to read a little bit from the farming section. You wrote, thanks to these advancements, the global risk of death from famine has plummeted from approximately 7% in the 1930s to well below 1% today, which also is like another way to frame up like how impactful that has been on society's evolution in production. That maybe we're not gaining because it's getting easier to make the basket and the dollar's being debased. But what it's doing for just, you know, fighting hunger, you know, is incredible. So what about data storage? You know, you mentioned that before, but like using the example of clay tablets.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that kind of the famine idea is also just highlighting like how much wealthier humanity has become over the last 200 plus years. Like it's not just, you know, a few wealthy elite that are becoming incredibly wealthy, which is somewhat the case today, but it's also everyone is kind of rising together with this new technology that's been discovered and these new innovations that make all of these things more productive and more efficient. But yeah, so data storage is another one that's kind of crazy to think about. So if you go back to something like, you know, 1000 BC or 2000 BC, if you wanted to record 1 gigabyte worth of data on clay tablets, it would take about 1 million days to do this. And now, you know, if you have a basic computer or, you know, you have any knowledge about, you know, gigabytes and computers at this point and hard drives, to record 1 gigabyte today on a simple solid state hard drive, it would take less than a second. And so just, it's kind of mind blowing to see the innovation in something like data storage as well, which is like super intuitive. And obviously there's been massive deflation in the ability to store, you know, gigabytes worth of data over the years, but it's kind of crazy to like put it that way and show like how much more efficient we've really become, you know, over the last 2000 plus years.
Yeah. I mean, these gains in efficiency are incredible. Another one would be telecommunications. So maybe you could start with carrier pigeons.
Yeah. This one, this one, I forgot the exact, like crazy numbers, but it is something insane that like we were able to transmit, you know, it took forever. I think with carrier pigeons, it would take like infinite amount of time basically to, transmit like a gigabyte of data. And then now we can do that in like 1 second as well. So it's just kind of crazy to think about.
Yeah. I mean, it's what, 100,000 pigeons for 1 gigabyte of data. You know, because considering their flight speed, which you noted is like 50 to 60 miles per hour. I mean, none of this just really scales, but it just shows, I mean, what it reminds me of, especially what I thought was so interesting about this, is like I had forgotten to think of carrier pigeons as part of the evolution of technology or telecommunications, and how far, when you think about it that way, things have come. Because I think a lot of people think about sort of like data storage is going from like, you know, a floppy disk to a CD to a DVD to maybe an SSD, but like forgetting about like play tablets and writing on walls and, you know, the scalability of that, or even, you know, or like maybe people start with maybe the printing press in terms of storing information. But what about oil production and what kind of evolution have we seen there?
So this is another pretty interesting one. When the oil industry started in the 1860s, one employee in the U.S. was able to produce 0.3 barrels of oil per day. Now one employee in the U.S. produces 100 barrels of oil per day. And so this is just kind of another mind-blowing fact where it's like you see gas prices going up year after year and people keep complaining about that. Yet from the, you know, origin of the oil industry, we've become, you know, 300x or magnitudes more efficient and more productive at producing this oil. And so this you know, innovation and accelerating productivity that we've seen in the digital space, including data storage, telecommunications, like we just talked about, this is actually happening in the physical world as well. It's happening a lot slower, obviously. You know, when you go from storing 1 gigabyte, you know, takes however long, 1 million days, and now it takes 1 second. It's still pretty impressive to think that like we're becoming significantly more productive at oil. Now it's marginally less productive or compared to, you know, storing data or transmitting data over long distances. But and that's obviously why, and you know, the price of gas has gone, you know, up over time relative to like the cost to store a gigabyte worth of data has actually gone down over time, even in dollars. But when you're measuring these both in Bitcoin terms, they're both actually going down in Bitcoin terms, because Bitcoin is one in the monetization phase, but two, it's actually good money that's not being manipulated like the dollar is to make sure that it's actually getting debased against, you know, gas prices and a bunch of other consumer goods.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, it's, yeah, I love it. So I want to talk about the evolution of lumber and production and, you know, kind of its impact on residential real estate.
Yeah. So lumber is the last one in this acceleration of production section. The one fact that I think is quite interesting is from 1900 to 2017, lumber production in the U.S. increased by roughly 6x per employee. And one of the reasons I chose lumber to kind of look at here is because lumber is one of the main input costs to residential real estate. You know, everyone's house is, you know, has a bunch of wood in it, right? That's how we build houses. And so if, you know, we're becoming more productive at producing lumber, and theoretically, you know, that can be applied to, or that's a key input cost to residential housing, then over time, as humans become more productive at producing lumber and putting it all together to build a house, then the same concept of, hey, we're becoming more productive at building houses, which is a traditional asset that many people use to store their wealth in today, maybe it's not very smart to be storing your wealth in, you know, this three bedroom house or these single family houses all over the US or all over the world, when we're actually becoming a lot more productive at producing the input cost to build these houses. Now, of course, again, lumber, just like oil, it's going up in dollar terms because it's the productivity rate is not quite the same as data storage or telecommunications. But the same idea applies. If you look at the price of lumber and Bitcoin, this, you know, innovation is actually being reflected in the price. Lumber is getting a lot cheaper in Bitcoin. And of course, like I mentioned, due to the monetization phase, it's extreme. It's very extreme. But I think it will continue even past the monetization phase, even, you know, post hyper Bitcoinization. There's a reason to keep expecting, you know, technology deflation to continue to lower the price of lumber, and then ultimately maybe continue to lower the price of residential real estate as well.
Right. Well, yeah, we would love to see that. And, you know, thinking about sort of lumber and even oil, and I know it's not noted in the report, but I can't help but think that, like, you know, I've heard about synthetic lumber. I don't know how much we're using it in residential real estate industry. And, you know, I know I've seen synthetic oil put in my car, and I don't know if I think they used to sell that to me because it would be cheaper to put it in the car. But it seems like whenever I go get an oil change now with synthetic oil, it's more to get the oil change. So they seem to get you there. And I don't know if we have synthetic oil. Why are we paying a lot for regular oil? I have no idea what's going on. But I'd like to move to the next part of the report. How is Bitcoin a deep freeze? Or, if I ask that another way, how, ineffective is our saving when everything we can save is, can be produced in greater quantities or devalued by competitive markets?
Yeah. So, kind of like I mentioned at the very start, Bitcoin is just the world's best money. I think 99.9% of the world has no idea that that's the case, or they're doubtful that's the case, but it is the case. Bitcoin is a deep freeze because no matter how much time and energy you spend trying to produce Bitcoin, you're not going to be able to produce more of it. It's if you run a Bitcoin full node on your computer or on any computer, you can set the rules of the network and say, hey, I will enforce this rule that there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. No matter how much hash power comes on the network, no matter what other people, someone else thinks or another entity thinks or government thinks or a corporation thinks, they cannot go on your computer, change your rule that you're running on your device and say there's going to be more than 21 million Bitcoin. Whereas you compare this to all other traditional assets, whether that's dollars, bonds, stocks, gold, real estate, all of these assets we can create more of or we can devalue, kind of like we were talking about with the calculator example or the strawberry example. And so Bitcoin is this one asset that no matter how efficient the market capitalism gets or how innovative new technology becomes, we're not going to be able to figure out how to produce more Bitcoin. And comparing it to the acceleration of production, we're figuring out how to do a lot of things very fast, very quickly, and very efficiently. You may not feel it in dollar terms sometimes, but in Bitcoin terms, we're feeling it for sure. Things are getting a lot cheaper and a lot more productive and a lot more efficient. And that's because Bitcoin is this deep freeze, and it doesn't just apply to this idea of acceleration production and not freezing your wealth or the fact that your wealth is melting or prices are melting doesn't just apply to basic consumer goods like lumber or energy or whatnot. It actually applies to all these traditional assets that people are using to hold their wealth in. And so, Bitcoin is effectively the best way to store wealth for an extremely long time horizon.
Sure. And then, how would you kind of answer, is Bitcoin valuable because of its scarce supply?
Yeah, so there's a lot more to Bitcoin than just its scarcity, right? Bitcoin is the world's best money because of its unique monetary properties. And so just because something is scarce doesn't mean it's value. Something that's good money and scarce is extremely valuable, right? Like Bitcoin is portable, durable, divisible, and fungible. And because Bitcoin is objectively the best money, it has objectively the best monetary properties, and it happens to be perfectly scarce, then the world is going to converge on Bitcoin as money. And kind of maybe taking a step back, like what is money? Well, money solves something called the double coincidence of wants, where if I sell strawberries and you sell apples, the only way we're going to trade with each other without money is if I happen to produce strawberries today and you happen to want strawberries, and then I happen to want apples and you happen to have extra apples. So we need to find one common tool that we're going to use for savings and trade to be used as money. And so that's the idea. There's no point in holding the second best money, because if you're holding the second best money, then you're hoping or you're betting that other people holding the second best money aren't going to cash out to the first best money before you. And so since Bitcoin is objectively the best money because of its unique monetary properties, then effectively everyone needs to cash out of all of their other money-like tools that they're using and cash out to Bitcoin soon as possible.
Right. And so, I kind of want to move into the next section where we look at some of the traditional ways to kind of store wealth. And I think we'll gloss through the dollar. I don't think we have to kind of, but I do want to talk about bonds, because I kind of like the way you kind of explain why bonds might not be the best way to store your wealth if you're not a big fan of the dollar.
Yeah. So What are bonds for people that may not know? Well, bond is a promise for a fixed amount of future dollars. Like we were talking about before, dollars are effectively a unit of account or an asset that's tied to a basket of consumer goods. Like we talked about with the acceleration of production section, this basket of consumer goods is becoming more abundant, more productive. We're able to produce these things very cheaply and more efficiently. And in real terms, we're doing it better and faster than ever before. And so there's already a very bad, you know, storing dollars doesn't make sense because it's that basket of goods that's getting devalued even more on top of the acceleration of production. Bonds is a promise for a fixed amount of these future dollars. Now, of course, above holding cash, you're going to get some form or, you know, sometimes there's negative yielding bonds, but that was a temporary problem in the fiat world. But today, you'll typically get a positive nominal real return for lending dollars to somebody else. But at the end of the day, it's still a promise for a fixed amount of future dollars. But when you're lending this money, whether it's to a government or a corporation or to anybody else, there's default risk. There's risk with these bonds. You know, this entity or this corporation may not pay you back. Maybe they'll default. Maybe their business won't perform as they expected. So there's risk. So the return that the yield that you're getting on these bonds doesn't come without risk. Like there's going to be risk on the bonds. If it's government that's yielding or, you know, that is offering the bond to you and you're the one lending dollars to them, well, the government can pay you back in printed money. They can print the money and give you back. So maybe they'll, you know, never default in nominal terms, but the printed money that they give you back might not buy you, you know, might not even buy you the same amount of consumer goods that you wanted, but especially probably won't be buying you the same amount of Bitcoin that you probably should have bought to begin with. So yeah, the idea with bonds is it's just a promise for a fixed amount of future dollars. But if you go out further on the risk curve and try to get a higher yield with your bonds, then there's going to be risk to that. And, you know, over the long run, it's probably going to equal out to where you're not going to make too much of a crazy return by lending to some aggressive or risky counterparty.
Right. And then back to our boy, Eugene Fama, you know, is there any way in the market, anywhere in the market to get a free lunch?
Yeah. So again, kind of the idea of you're walking down the street, you see a $100 bill on the sidewalk, you know, most likely you should pick it up as fast as possible, but most likely it won't be there because someone else probably picked it up before you. Now we live in a world with, you know, 8 billion people all interconnected. We have like AIs probably trading the markets. We have these machine learning algorithms trading the markets. Like people are looking for any slice of potential alpha that's out there based on, you know, all of the knowledge and information that humanity has out there on the internet. And there's just not really many free lunches out there to make a crazy return. So if you happen to find, you know, a bond or an equity that you're like, oh, wow, like this is a complete no-brainer, it's not priced correctly, you know, odds are you're probably missing something and there's not quite that free lunch that you expect. And maybe you should probably just buy Bitcoin.
Right. So then, you know, I mean, speaking of other things you could buy, though, you know, looking at stocks, like, can you explain Adam Smith's concept of the invisible hand?
Yeah. So Adam Smith's concept of the invisible hand is the idea that over time, you know, the market is going to trend towards efficiency, and the end game of, you know, companies competing with each other and everyone acting in their own self-interest is to benefit the consumer. When all of these companies go out there and, you know, compete on in their own self-interest, they try to maximize their own profits and they're all competing each other within an open and free and permissionless market, then the end goal is profits end up trending toward the, you know, lowest possible amount. And the benefit is not necessarily to the companies or the, you know, the monopolies that would exist or that could theoretically exist or these big, large corporations. The end game is the consumers are the ones that benefit when, you know, there's capitalism, open, free global markets.
Right. And then, so like kind of continuing with stocks though, like what does it mean to invest in stocks? Like what am I actually getting?
Yeah. So when you buy a stock, you're effectively buying a stream of future cash flows of the company, right? And these companies, in my opinion, and I think even people in like traditional finance would probably argue this, that everything feels massively overvalued today. Like we're if you're looking at, IBM or Coca-Cola or Nvidia in particular, like you're going to be paying a very high multiple for that stream of future cash flows. And those future cash flows could also be like years and years into the future. You can be buying a company that currently loses money every year, yet if the company's going to make billions and billions of dollars in the future, then maybe it's a good bet. And there's no reason to think that people obviously won't be investing in equities in the future. They'll just be paying more realistic valuations for these equities. And right now, a lot of the valuations don't make sense, especially when you start looking at these companies in Bitcoin terms and seeing like, hey, their revenues and their profits are actually shrinking over time. And so your future cash flows are shrinking over time. So there's no reason to be paying, 20x or 30x revenue for this crazy company that, doesn't even make money today and might, hopefully theoretically make money in the future. And so, yeah,
Right.
that's, yeah.
Kind of gambling a bit, but I mean, I get how, Amazon, didn't generate a lot of profits to eat a lot of sectors of the economy and verticals and integrate and expand. And then, AWS gets, evolves out of their suite of products, which probably wasn't even seen when they came up with that plan. But even now they're probably facing, threats from China we didn't see 20 years ago, and that website, I don't know what it's called, like Temu. I think I saw it all the Super
Yeah.
Bowl, one sports bowl I watched this year. But like, so it's nothing lasts forever in that, I think, realm is what I'm kind of getting at there. But what did the McKinsey study find about brutal competition and creative destruction?
Yeah, so this was quite interesting, and to me it makes sense. I don't remember the exact numbers. I'm sure you may have them, but they're in the report. But it's the general idea that the lifespan or the company life cycle of a typical company in the S&P 500 or some typical American stock index right now is shrinking over time. And I think it plays into the whole idea of which effectively means like companies used to last say 35 years in the S&P 500 and now they last maybe 15 years and then they're cycled out and replaced by a new innovative new company that wasn't in the index beforehand. And it makes sense to me because technology is accelerating. There's VC, like the idea of VC and venture capital and like investing in startups, I feel like over the last 30 plus years has become a massive industry. Like there's so many new innovative ideas that like OpenAI, for example, like it just came out of pretty much nowhere, and then became an $80 billion company, still private, obviously, but the same idea can apply to a lot of companies that are ideas that can come out of nowhere, become very large companies, and effectively be eating at the market cap. Or the market value stuck in Nvidia or stuck in Apple and stuck in whatever. And so this concept of, okay, if the company life cycle is shrinking over time and the winners are maybe like these early stage companies that go from zero to $100 billion really fast and then get added to the S&P 500 index kind of potentially prevents or presents a problem to people that are investing in passive index funds like the S&P 500, where it's like, okay, if that's the case and this company life cycle gets shorter and shorter over time, then maybe it's what's going to happen is like you're just going to be buying the top of like these VC bags every time the company exits and gets really popular. Kind of like going back to our strawberry company, it's like, okay, you have this normal strawberry farm that's doing very well. All of a sudden, AI and robotics drive the cost of production down super low. And their profits look really good because they can continue selling at a massive value, or the normal market price. Their profits soar, they get added to the S&P 500. Your retirement automatically smash buys the strawberry farm. And then all of a sudden, the markets gets more efficient, prices of strawberries start to come back down. And then all of a sudden it's like, wow, you bought the top of the strawberry company. And then eventually the life cycle of the company went back down and got out competed by another new innovative technology or new company or new strawberry farm that, replaces it. And that can be, Nvidia today would be a good example to kind of match with that, where it's like Nvidia right now is, potentially making GPUs at $500 and then selling it for $30,000. And it's like someone out there may be able to create the same GPU for cheaper, or might be able to make the same GPU for more expensive and then just sell it for a less, you know, smaller market price, and then start eating away at NVIDIA's margins. So it's this, just this idea that company lifecycle is shrinking, and you know, maybe even passive index funds aren't quite as safe as people might think they are.
Yeah, well, I like how you kind of frame it up, as because a lot of people think of like Bitcoin as this $1.2 trillion bounty. I know that because I got the block clock flashing in the background. And, you know, you framed it as like Apple is a $3 trillion, you know, bounty that civilization is effectively, you know, saying, well, you know, no one's going to create a better and less expensive, you know, consumer electronics, or, you know, NVIDIA is a $1.7 trillion bounty on chips. It's very interesting to think about it that way. And frame it as, you know, someone's coming for them, and yep, it's probably not going to last forever. So then what would you say is, you know, the critical issue to consider there?
Yeah, I mean, I think like when I've heard Saylor mention this, he's like, the FANG companies, or like the Magnificent Seven or whatever, they don't have, he says, like the capital structure to store $100 trillion worth of wealth in them. And I think like when he says that, he kind of means like what we're saying, where it's like, if you tried to just put $100 trillion in Apple, and like, that's where you decided to store your wealth in, well, that's just going to be a massive, massive bounty to actually go out and build a better iPhone, or better, you know, Mac, or better iPad, or better AirPods, or whatever. And you're just not going to be able to store that much wealth in Apple. Like, it's going to get siphoned off through management, through VC, you know, VCs funding competitors, right? And so the big critical idea here is like, there's only so much wealth we can store outside of Bitcoin. I think we've become so wealthy over the last 200 years. You know, we invented the telegraph, and then soon invented the internet. We invented the plane and then landed on the moon soon after too. Like, we've become so wealthy and so productive and so efficient over the last 200 years, but we have no real place to store this wealth. So we've resorted to like hoarding all of these like crazy assets to like crazy valuations, whether that's real estate, whether that's equities, whether that's gold or whatever. Like, these valuations don't really make sense. And it's because we're trying to fit all of this wealth into these buckets that like don't hold wealth correctly. Like, they're all leaking, they're all melting. And so the big idea is like, we actually now, thanks to Bitcoin, we have this asset that doesn't leak and it doesn't melt, and it actually has the capital structure to hold $100 trillion worth of wealth, or even more, because the market or technology and, you know, capitalism can't suck wealth out of Bitcoin. It's money. So you can't create more monies and compete with it that way. And it's also just finite in supply. So it's those two things that make Bitcoin just very difficult to melt from the outside. Whereas all of these other assets, especially, you know, stocks and gold and real estate, whatnot, we can melt these assets, and the market is, you know, incentivized to melt these assets. Like you mentioned, it's a bounty to actually melt these assets.
Yeah. And the way I kind of think about it is like melting up is, you know, not only do we have to kind of increase these assets because we have all these dollars, but because it's a credit-based system, we have to find places to shove debt. So, home prices go up, so we have to financialize homes. So we have to create mortgages, which creates all this, you know, debt, because you need debt to buy a home because they're not affordable because we're debasing the money. But now you need to find somewhere to shove all that debt, all those mortgages, and everything else, all those auto loans and everything else in the economy, all the credit card loans. And so the more wealth we create, the more we debase, the more credit we have to create, the more we have to find like heat sinks for all of it. And you kind of destroyed, you know, the idea, I think, of the traditional Buffett model of investing. And, you know, that's not really holding up in the 21st century, because it's not going to work with passive investing and how you create these bounties just with supermarket shop, it's like going to the supermarket every month. And if, like, you know, you want to buy 10 tomatoes every week, and, you know, they're a dollar a piece, and then the next time you go, they're $10 a piece, but you're like, they're on my list, I'm just buying them. Tomatoes are up, I should buy more. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah. You would be like, I'm not putting tomatoes on the sandwich this week, I'm going to use lettuce. Yeah. Lettuce is still a normal price. I don't think we have to get into how stocks can be diluted. I don't think we have to get into the gold and silver section. But and you do, you know, I mean, because gold is not really scarce, and you note that. But let's get into real estate a little bit. How is real estate an adequate investment due to everyone's need for housing, though?
Yeah. Yeah, you make a good point also about the debt. Like, obviously, that plays a key role in massively inflating asset prices as well. But yeah, real estate is very interesting, right? And I hear people say, like, okay, I want to hoard or hold or save real estate because everyone needs real estate. But I don't think that, like, that's not a good answer. It's like, it's kind of like saying, okay, I want to save or hoard oxygen because everyone needs oxygen. Well, it's like, obviously that's not the entire case of like why you want to hold real estate. Like, you can hold a lot of things that people desperately need, but if we can create more of it and produce more of it at cheaper prices, then maybe you shouldn't, you know, be hoarding real estate. Like, you shouldn't be hoarding food and stuff like that. So real estate, I don't think it has been a great investment over the last, you know, 50 plus years or whatnot. But I think now that Bitcoin exists and we have an alternative place to store wealth that can't be debased, Bitcoin is far better. And I think, you know, people will say things like, oh, well, like, you're not going to be able to really create more land. And I don't necessarily buy that either, right? We have, you know, 50% of Earth's land remains relatively untouched by humans. Like, most land is not even developed right now, and we can, you know, build more stuff. We can do whatever we want with that land. There's also, you know, examples of history where it's like Boston, which Saylor put on his slide deck. I don't know if you saw it at the MicroStrategy conference. He put the image of Boston in Your Wealth is Melting report. In his slide deck, which is pretty cool. And it shows that, like, actually, we're making more land. Like, we're literally making more land. I watched a video on YouTube about this idea of, like, land in Boston, and the lady, the historian that, like, lives in Boston and, like, has studied, like, how they literally made more land in Boston. She literally said the term here is land making. We are making more land. And it's kind of funny. Like, people don't even think that's possible, but if people demand land, we're going to build more land. And we've done that. Another thing is Palm Jumeirah. I think that's how you pronounce it. That's an artificial island off the coast of Dubai. It's, you know, completely land, you know, man-made island that it, and there's 10,000 plus residents that live there. Like, that's a lot of people that live on this, you know, literally land that we created out of nothing. And, you know, if people demand beachfront property, the market is going to figure out how to build beachfront property. And it's done that for 10,000 plus people. The other thing I think is interesting is, like, we can build up, right? If people are just looking for a basic place to live and, you know, investors are out there hoarding a bunch of single family houses, well, like, we can build up. You can build, you know, 3-bedroom, 2-bedroom, 1-bedroom apartments in massive, you know, 200 or 100 something floor buildings. And that's very possible. Like, the Burj Khalifa is 164 floors tall. Like, that's a pretty massive building. So, like, even like surface area on Earth, if you assume, like, it's very difficult to make more land or we're not going to do it, we can still build up, and we can build up massively compared to what we've done already today. On top of that, like, you also have property tax. Land is monetized today, but it's not very portable. So it's very easy to be taxed. You know, like, in the US, you might pay like 0.5% or 1% of your property value every year on property taxes. So your property is leaking or melting that way. And last, on the top of all of that, you know, real estate, or at least property, like, you know, a house or an apartment, is made of lumber, it's made of steel, it's made of plastic, it's made of all these different things that decay over time. It's in the physical world that where things actually break. Like, you'll need to redesign stuff, the kitchen, you'll need to, you know, there'll be floods or whatnot in apartment complexes. There will be, you know, bad things that happen, things can catch on fire. People will just, if you have tenants in your apartment and you're trying to get cash flow out of your real estate, then, you know, people could, you know, damage the house. And in fact, like, that's pretty normal. Like if you live in a house for 10 years, like things are going to naturally break. Like that's just the natural process of physical items. So yeah, I think there's a lot of problems with real estate that a lot of people overlook. And it's very, in my opinion, it's kind of, once you like really take a step back and like look at all the ways it could go wrong or that your asset could leak or melt, like your real estate is melting. And it's very clear if you look at it in Bitcoin terms.
Yeah, for real. And what's interesting, I like how you know, it's like artificial land. You mentioned Dubai. I swear, I think they're going to connect Manhattan to Brooklyn one day under the Brooklyn Bridge. They're just going to keep evolving those two land masses. It's valuable. You know, the joke, one of the best memes of the last 4 years or whatnot, maybe one of the best, but one notable one I remember is, you know, the guy wearing the T-shirt, we're, you know, don't come, we're too crowded. And it's like, you know, Montana's behind him or Wyoming. And the irony there is these days, I think what was used to be undesirable land in America in some ways, or in, you know, maybe on the coast, is to Bitcoin is maybe more desirable than ever.
That's a good point.
This untouched, beautiful land that's less crowded. So I think in no way we're too crowded. And you kind of get about this in the port, but it's like, and you mentioned this with Dubai. So we can make now, because, you know, you'd say, well, maybe the land is scarce, but people want to live in nice climates. Like not everyone can live in, I guess, Florida and Texas anymore, you know, but we can create great climates in horrible, hospitable environments. And with, especially with things like air conditioning, you know, and
great point.
Yeah. And this doesn't, I think you mentioned the port too, but we can go to space and, you know, times of war and excess government spending, real estate could be a little tricky. And, you know, even you know, with space, but, and maybe, you know, real estate's a bit of a legal construct, but does this imply that real estate lacks potential opportunities for generating returns anywhere?
I would say no there. Like all of these things, like whether it's equities, even lending, you know, money or real estate, like there's going to be ways for entrepreneurs, smart entrepreneurs, to go out there and extract alpha and generate returns, whether that's, you know, a growing city, you're building, you know, a building or a neighborhood in one of the most efficient ways possible. And like you have real alpha over the market, like people will still be able to make money doing a lot of these things. Where I'm going, or where I tried to go with this report, is to kind of separate the difference between investing and saving. Right now, I think everyone is out there, they're trying to just save for the future. They're like, okay, like I'm working at my day-to-day job. I'm trying to, you know, save for the future. And by doing that, I'm creating this, you know, massive, crazy, diversified portfolio full of all these different random assets that I have no idea how they actually work. Don't even know what they do. I don't even know what I hold. I just know, you know, my financial advisor tells me all of this. And I, you know, hopefully he's right. And hopefully these things keep going up. And I don't think that that's the correct way to save for the future. I think the correct way to save for the future is by buying Bitcoin and holding Bitcoin in cold storage. And so, yeah, I mean, like there's going to be ways to generate returns in real estate. And, you know, if you're an expert in real estate or you're an expert in a specific area, maybe you'll be able to do this. Maybe this will be your job or maybe this will be your company. But it's not okay to blindly throw your excess savings or wealth at real estate and just hope, you know, it keeps going up and it doesn't decay over time and you'll never be able to, you know, and that's the best way to save for the future. It's not the best way to save for the future. The best way to save for the future is just holding Bitcoin.
Yeah, I love how this report explores the changing relationship between production and saving, but also, you know, distinguishes, I think, between saving and investing. And, you know, we've kind of been talking about that, I think, a lot through this conversation, but can you invest and save in Bitcoin?
It's a good question.
And maybe I mean, it should be and or. You know, are some people investing in Bitcoin? Are some people saving in Bitcoin? If you have a, let's say you're 25% allocated to Bitcoin, could 5% of that be your savings because that's what you would save in a perfect world, and 20% be your investment in Bitcoin because you want a little more in Bitcoin than you just want your savings? And, you know, I think some way to frame that up, and I think one of my prior guests kind of said, like, you know, small, you know, some allocation is savings, another allocation is sort of your investing. And then, like, if you're heavily allocated, you're trying to retire earlier, you're YOLOing, you know, and so I, like, maybe you could think about it like you know, there's Bitcoin, maybe you stack your stats, right? Your DCA or whenever you smash buy. But then maybe like if you get paid in Bitcoin, that's kind of income. And some of that could be savings or investment, you know?
Yeah.
And convert it or not into long-term storage or back to cash for expenses, especially if you're in a 100% Bitcoin world. Some of it you're going to convert back. So it's not for savings or investment. It's for spending.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because like Bitcoin is super volatile, you know, especially during the monetization phase. So it's like, I've personally never been a fan of being 100% in on Bitcoin. Like, I don't think that's the best way to go about what you're doing. I think that that's kind of what you're talking about. Like, that's a more aggressive strategy where if like you're really trying to retire early and you know, you're like Bitcoin's going to go up very fast, very soon, then maybe that can work for you. But I don't think that that's maybe like the best, most risk adjusted way to navigate hyper Bitcoinization. So yeah, like in that way, if you have, you know, if you're being a super, super aggressive, maybe you can think of like, okay, I'm investing or speculating on the short-term movement of Bitcoin, because if I happen to lose my job over the next couple months and Bitcoin falls, you know, 80%, like it historically does, you know, every few years, then you're going to be selling Bitcoin at a loss from what you may be holding at today. And that's probably not going to be good. And you're not going to be happy about that. So yeah, like in that way, you know, if you put your short-term savings into Bitcoin, which may be best today to hold dollars, then maybe you're quote unquote investing in Bitcoin. But yeah, no, I think like Bitcoin is for your long-term savings that, you know, you don't mind if it falls 80% or 50% in, you know, the next 12 months, you're still going to be okay. And hopefully you will be in a position where you won't have to sell your Bitcoin.
Right. And so, you know, kind of going further, is Bitcoin optional? Is it no longer? Yeah. Is it optional still?
Taking it on like a long time horizon, if we're right about Bitcoin and Bitcoin is the world's best money, which I think it is, and we're navigating through hyper Bitcoinization, I would say like Bitcoin is not optional, right? Like it's similar to gunpowder, where gunpowder, you know, if your enemy or the civilization next to you discovered it before you did and you were still using bow and arrows, then they're going to be able to conquer you if they so decide to. Bitcoin is similar from a finance or economic perspective, where if you are, you know, relying on the existing system to hold your wealth in, you know, index funds or overvalued real estate or whatnot, and your enemy or your competitor is, you know, pulling the Michael Saylor strategy and upgrading their balance sheet to Bitcoin and using Bitcoin as a monetary asset, that doesn't, you know, insulate you from, you know, avoiding Bitcoin or avoiding the implications of not holding Bitcoin, right? Like over the last 15 years, you were probably a lot better off buying Bitcoin instead of doing whatever else you were doing in the market or whatever else your company was doing. So you can ignore it and you can pretend it's optional, but in reality, it's like you're losing, you're missing out on real wealth that you could be accumulating. And that's just not how, you know, that's not great. Like in that way, it's not optional, to where if you want to actually, you know, outcompete your competitors, you need to recognize what tools that you have at hand, and you need to be able to, you know, pick the best tool and start holding the best tool, or start performing economic calculation using the best tool. And maybe once you figure out that, hey, there's this new tool exists, and it exists whether I believe in it or don't believe in it, and you know, my assets are melting or leaking or decreasing rapidly denominated in this new tool, then maybe I should just buy this new tool and get out of speculating in the market when I may not be speculating on something that I don't understand.
Right. No, I can see that. And so I want to read a little bit from this report before we round out. The promise of Bitcoin is that it reintroduces the concept of true savings. Quote, "There is and always has been a fundamental difference between saving and investment. Savings are held in the form of monetary assets, and investments are savings which are put at risk. The lines may have been blurred as the economic system financialized, but Bitcoin will unblur the lines and make the distinction obvious once again. Money with the right incentive structure will overwhelm demand for complex financial assets and debt instruments." Parker Lewis from Gradually Then Suddenly. Once you begin to accept that using traditional assets for long-term savings isn't wise because Bitcoin exists and has a credibly finite supply, Bitcoin itself only further illuminates the problems it solves by serving as a constant to measure other asset classes against. When measured in a perfectly scarce asset like Bitcoin, the ways the long-term value of all these asset classes is challenged becomes clearer than ever, particularly in an age where production capabilities are rapidly expanding and markets are increasingly global, interconnected, and highly competitive. So one of my final questions, if not my final question, is what might be good risk-adjusted investments in a Bitcoin world?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think, like, you know, post-hyper-Bitcoinization, or even today, like when you're evaluating investments, because you can be choosing to live on a Bitcoin standard today, and using Bitcoin as like your default long-term unit of account. Good investments in a Bitcoin world are, one, obviously going to outperform Bitcoin, and they're going to outperform Bitcoin on like a risk-adjusted manner. And so anything that's profitable has the potential to be a good risk-adjusted investment in the world of Bitcoin. Now, the big question mark, and the reason why, you know, you wouldn't buy everything that's profitable today, is because you'd be paying the wrong valuation for all these profitable things. You'd be paying 30x revenue or 20x revenue or whatever, you know, the market rate for whatever company you're evaluating, whatever industry or whatever real estate. Like, you can, there might be a great way to buy real estate and rent it out, and maybe it's a good risk-adjusted return for doing that. And so, yeah, you just have to make sure you're buying anything profitable at the right valuation, which would be like, you know, recognizing like, okay, maybe I'll buy Apple, but I want, you know, Apple to be trading at like a PE ratio of like 8. So I know that, like, you know, in 8 years, if their earnings remain the same, I'll probably be able to get my money back. And then after that, you know, it's profit. And if their earnings are growing under a Bitcoin standard, that would be even better. So you just have to make sure you buy profitable companies at the right valuation. Also, you know, we mentioned real estate, but also you have early stage companies, right? Like, any early stage company that could even be unprofitable may, like we talked about Amazon earlier, you know, early on, it wasn't very profitable. People were saying like, oh, this will never work. Like, what are you doing? But eventually, you know, it starts spitting off billions of dollars of, you know, free cash flow every year. And so if you, you know, now maybe under a Bitcoin standard, they would be more incentivized to try to generate profits sooner rather than later. But, you know, eventually it ended up being a very good investment despite having a very long time horizon. So anything unprofitable that is going to spit out, you know, positive Bitcoin denominator or Bitcoin cash flows at some point in the future could also be, you know, reasonable to invest in today. You just also have to make sure you're buying it at the right valuation, depending on what you expect the future cash flows of that, you know, startup company to be, which is obviously extremely difficult to determine. But you just got to make sure, you know, you're not overpaying for any crazy investments.
Sure. And I love this quote that you kept in the report from Ayn Rand. Or is it Ayn Rand? We can ignore reality, but we cannot ignore the consequences of ignoring reality. And you go on to write in the report, as these asset holders begin to recognize these truths and begin to understand that Bitcoin is a superior alternative because it certainly cannot be debased and touts the necessary properties of good money, then the price of these assets relative to Bitcoin could begin to fall significantly even before any massive supply increase or creative destruction occurs, just from a few holders cashing out for Bitcoin. Markets are forward-looking. If Bitcoin is going to be more resistant to debasement compared to gold, real estate, or other assets, even if it occurs very slowly, then you should still cash out to Bitcoin sooner rather than later. That's why Bitcoin has a compound annual growth rate of 138% over the last 13 years. The world is rushing out of inferior assets and funneling capital into the apex form of property. With this understanding, the only way to safely invest in innovation is by adopting Bitcoin as your unit of account and measuring your opportunity cost against it. Currently, amidst vast global speculation and a hyper-financialized economic system due to bad money, there aren't many clearly viable risk-adjusted opportunities outside of cold storage Bitcoin. What do you think about, you know, or how do you explain maybe Bitcoin as unit of account, how important that to you, or thinking in Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's super important. I think, like, when I like started writing this report, some pushback from some people were like, there's a simpler way to think about all of this. And it's like the idea that Bitcoin is just better money. So like, you know, Bitcoin's a good investment, not because, you know, all of your assets are falling in Bitcoin terms right now, but it's just better money. So like, that's the very clear way to think about it. But like, part of the reason why I wanted to write it like from this perspective, which I think is very different from how most people pitch Bitcoin or try to, you know, explain Bitcoin to new people as better money, it's because I wanted people to think about Bitcoin as a unit of account and as money. And because like, if Bitcoin actually is good money, that's how we should be using money. Like people, normal people are definitely not considering the idea of like measuring their wealth in Bitcoin terms. Yet if Bitcoin is money, which I think it is, and it's objectively the best money, then you should be doing this. Like that's kind of actually the whole purpose of money. Like we talked about, there's no like clear use case for money other than saving and trading with other people. Like that's the whole purpose of money. And when you're saving and trading with other people, you're going to be measuring things in that money to determine if you're making a profit, to determine if this trade is good for you or if this trade is bad for you, and all sorts of things like that. So unit of account kind of like ties everything together and it helps you recognize that like, if Bitcoin is good money, you should be using the ledger and the accounting system of Bitcoin to measure how you're performing. And so I think it's very important. And I think it's, you know, it's a unique way to think about Bitcoin that not many people are doing yet, because we're still like so early in the monetization phase. And, you know, price of everything is just collapsing in Bitcoin terms because Bitcoin adoption is going from like 0% to 0.1%. And it will then go to, you know, 1% to 10% to even higher. But yeah, it's a good way to truly think about Bitcoin if you're really forward looking and willing to have a very long time horizon.
Yeah. And I mean, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation, Joe. I want to read a bit more from the report before we roll out.
Okay.
Satoshi broke economics with digital scarcity. No supply response destroys every model. Nick Bhatia, prior guest on the show, host of the Bitcoin Layer. And then you go on to write, there are early directional signals of what good risk-adjusted investments will look like in a world that has converged on Bitcoin. Even as Bitcoin itself is going through its monetization, Bitcoin companies, miners, Bitcoin development companies like MicroStrategy, world-changing innovations like NVIDIA, and some early-stage startups all show Bitcoin-denominated outperformance on various timelines. And perhaps, most importantly, anything that's profitable will, of course, still be valuable. You'll just have to make sure you purchase profitable assets at the right valuation that incorporates an appropriate risk premium over holding cold storage Bitcoin. As this century unfolds with its remarkable technology advancements, the traditional methods of saving increasingly fall short. All assets can be perpetually produced or devalued with natural free market forces, except Bitcoin. Bitcoin emerges not just as an alternative, but arguably as the best tool, a novel tool, for saving in this new era, because it is the best money. Its credibly fixed supply, coupled with its other superior monetary properties, positions it as a solution to the innovation trap humanity faces today. And the very fact that we've discovered the trap means we're close to the economic singularity, where most wealth ends up in Bitcoin. Bitcoin may be the only asset that can stop the free market from inevitably melting your wealth. So this report is awesome, and this conversation has been dope, but I get the rumor mill has it that you might be working on an even more bullish report. So I'd love to have you obviously back for that. Maybe you could just tease it out a little bit, share what you can.
Yeah, so it's I think it's going to be titled Measuring Bitcoin, and it's kind of going to be a little bit of a step further going off of your wealth is melting. I think I like originally needed to like set the stage of explaining to people that the highest long-term risk adjusted return is holding cold storage Bitcoin. And I think like your wealth is melting hopefully helps convince some people that might be the case. It's possible that it's the case. And I think it is. And measuring Bitcoin will kind of go into the idea of what the total addressable market for Bitcoin might be, and kind of go about measuring the total addressable market in a different way than I think anyone else has really done before. So I think it should be a pretty interesting and unique report.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait to get a copy, and then we'll get into it. I want to read the acknowledgments. I think this is important and sometimes, you know, not gets its due. So This is in Joe's words. I've been thinking about Bitcoin finance and computer science for many years now, and I want to add a small section to thank the people who helped formulate, critique, and sharpen my thoughts. First, I'd like to thank many of my old finance college friends who work or previously worked on Wall Street and investment banking, equity research, and private equity who still to this day chat Bitcoin with me. I'm proud of that many of them own some sats. From the Bitcoin community, I'd like to thank Eric Yates, Alan Farrington, Tori DeMeester, Cam Duty, Stephen Hall, Trey Sellers, Phil Geiger, and others for reviewing, critiquing, and thinking about this framing of Bitcoin and wealth. Last, I'd like to thank Unchained for enabling me to spend a portion of my time writing content like this that will hopefully encourage more individuals and enterprises to buy Bitcoin and ultimately hold it in the most secure manner possible, multi-sig collaborative custody. I hope that doesn't get you in trouble at work, that you're doing this there, but I'm sure they'll love it. Cold storage is the best way to go. So, you know, the report is your wealth is melting. Why Bitcoin is the deep freeze your portfolio desperately needs. So I'll leave it to you for any final thoughts and, you know, let us know where people can find you, your work, and Unchained for cold storage.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Cedric, for having me on. Really enjoyed it. I think this is one of the best Bitcoin podcasts out there. You can go find the report if you want to read the full thing at unchained.com/melting. Of course, I'm on Twitter as at III Capital, or you can search Joe Burnett. I'm also on YouTube. You can search Joe Burnett Bitcoin, or Joe Burnett 27 is my handle, but Joe Burnett Bitcoin should pull it up. But yeah, and if you want to buy Bitcoin or want to upgrade your cold storage of Bitcoin and you want to ensure that you're able to hold Bitcoin for not just yourself, but for generations to come, I think Unchained is a great solution for you, whether you're an individual, you're a company, small business, or a large enterprise.
Yeah, man, for sure. I can't tell you how much this has been incredible. Thank you so much, Joe. I can't wait to see what you do next.
Appreciate it, Cedric.
Today's episode with Joe Burnett is brought to you by River, the preferred choice for buying Bitcoin. Why do I recommend River? Because I personally use the service and they offer zero fees on recurring Bitcoin purchases. Get up to $100 when you sign up and buy Bitcoin at partner.river.com/matrix. Another thought, now is the perfect time to stack sats and store them tightly. Thea is the best place to do that, bar none. Check it out. Download Thea at theya.us/CEDRIC. That's thea.us/Cedric. And get your first 6 months free and secure your multi-generational Bitcoin legacy today. You can support the Bitcoin Matrix with a boost on the Fountain app and by writing a 5-star review wherever you dome your pods. That would really help me get the word out and help new listeners to find the show. And thank you for tuning in. Keep building, keep stacking, and always be laser focused out there. This is Cedric. Peace.